FBBN is a listener-supported ministry. Your gift today will help others around the world study God's Word. Click Donate now to support BBN.
If you don't understand Daniel, you will not understand prophecy. Now, the book of Daniel is set in a time of Israel's distress and apostasy. They're in captivity. The years, the centuries have gone on since the glory of Solomon's kingdom, because Solomon disobeyed God and married many wives that were not Jewish, not committed to the Jewish faith. His children were brought up sometimes in heathen religions. And the result was that after Solomon died, his kingdom was divided. Jeroboam took off 10 tribes and formed the northern kingdom, the kingdom of Israel. And every king of Israel was uniformly bad. They didn't have any good kings. The southern kingdom, composed of Judah and Benjamin, had a mixture, some good, some bad. And God was patient with them. He sent prophets to both these kingdoms, predicted that if they didn't turn to the Lord, he would judge them. And in due time, judgment came. The Assyrian armies came in and swept the 10 tribes into captivity. They surrounded Jerusalem, you remember, and then, due to prayer, God intervened and delivered the two remaining tribes. It wasn't until more than a century later that Nebuchadnezzar, leading the armies of Babylon, conquered Jerusalem. Babylon had defeated the Assyrian Empire in 612 BC, and Nineveh, its capital, was destroyed and so lost that for a while, until archaeologists rediscovered it in the 19th century, they thought maybe it never really existed. But it was a big city, and of course the book of Jonah brings that out. But in 605 BC, Nebuchadnezzar, who was general of the Babylonian army, was sweeping all of Western Asia. He surrounded Jerusalem, and in the summer, late summer of 605 BC, an archaeologist pretty well pin that date down, though you'll find different dates than this in your Bible, sometimes 604 or 606. He was able to conquer the city. Just about that time, his father died, and he became king of the Babylonian Empire. And he began a long reign of more than 40 years, a brilliant administrator, leader, military genius, one of the great men of the past that stand on the pages of history. Now, Nebuchadnezzar, after he conquered Jerusalem, immediately ordered to collect some of the royal children, to take them back to Babylon to be his servants. They also were a form of indemnity to keep Jerusalem from rebelling, because if he had the children of the royal family, they would be more inclined to serve Babylon. And among them was Daniel and his three companions. Their Hebrew, their Babylonian names were Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And they were teenagers, probably about 14 or 15 years of age. And here they were torn out of their homes, torn from their friends, taken off to a strange land, and there put in a school where their principal subject was the Babylonian religion. You see, Babylonian religion and politics were all mixed up because the king was considered a representative of the gods, and the whole thing was put together. So if they're going to serve the king, they had to know the Babylonian religion. And that was force feeding, they had to learn it. And so they were put to school for 3 years. Now, we have a lot of talk today about environmental psychology, and it's certainly true that environment makes a difference. That's why we have churches, that's why we have Christian schools. That's why we have Christian homes. It does make a difference what your environment is. But it's rather amazing how in the midst of Babylon, which is the most wicked city of the world, with every inducement to abandon their faith, after all, God had allowed Jerusalem to fall to the Babylonians, and to the Babylonians that meant that their gods were superior. They had every reason to desert their faith, but at least among the many dozens, probably, of young men that were carried off, there were these four that stood true. And, of course, Daniel was their leader. Now, I'm going to turn tonight to Daniel chapter 2, but just by way of review, you remember in Daniel chapter 1, Daniel was confronted with a problem. The Jewish law forbade eating certain foods and certain meats that weren't killed according to the Jewish code. And the Babylonian fair included these forbidden articles. And you remember how Daniel had to work around this and get permission to have a vegetarian diet, he and his three companions. And he did it very courteously and very wisely for a kid of 15 or 14 years of age, and he was allowed to have his own diet. Now, that doesn't sound very important, does it? But if that hadn't happened, you wouldn't have had a book of Daniel. You know, so many of the decisions we make at the time, especially young people, just casual decisions, you know, where are you going to go to school and who are your friends, and they turn out to be life-changing, don't they? And it doesn't take much of a derail to get a person outside the will of God. And Daniel, in this relatively small test, stood true. What an example he is to people who are caught up in our modern world, and it's a mess. I don't think adults all realize the pressures that young people are put under to give in to the standards, the worldly standards of their peers. And it's so difficult to stand true to the Lord in some circumstances, but Daniel and his companions did that, and there wouldn't have been a book of Daniel if they hadn't stood true. Now when we come to the second chapter of Daniel, we come to the great prophecy of the future of Gentile empires in the world from the time of Nebuchadnezzar, which was 600 years before Christ, until the second coming of Christ. Now that's a great expanse of time. It's already gone, as you can see, some 2,600 years. It's going to continue until the second coming. And nothing like this is found in any other book in the Bible. You don't have this comprehensive picture of future history, world history written in advance, like you have in the book of Daniel. And it came about through a dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. Now it says that Daniel and his companions had gone to 3 years of school, and it tells us in the closing verses of chapter 1 how well they had done. When Nebuchadnezzar examined them, it's interesting to me that the leader of this great empire was interested in these kids enough to interview each one of them personally. Nebuchadnezzar was a genius. He knew that his government was no better than the people under him. And so he's very much interested in these bright young lads. And he found that Daniel and his three companions were the top of the class. Though they had stood true to their faith, they still had mastered their subjects and gained his respect as the best in the graduating class. Now it says they were in school 3 years. Now you notice in chapter 2, the story there is laid in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar, and so it raises the question as to whether Daniel was still in school. Well, scholars wrangle about this, but the fact is the Babylonians, in counting a reign of a king, didn't count the fraction of the first calendar year. The year of accession was the first full calendar year. So it actually, from our viewpoint, was the third year. And it could have been called the close of it or something. It's possible that the 3 years of Daniel and his companions were school years, not necessarily 12 months. The implication is that Daniel had already graduated from school, or just had graduated, based on the last verses of chapter 1, when Nebuchadnezzar had this dream. Now, when you and I have a dream, it's because we've had a hamburger too late at night or something like that. But when a king has a dream, it becomes a national problem. And the king had a dream. And it says he was terrified by his dream. And he called in all his wise men. And this was the middle of the night, but kings didn't have too much regard for the problems of their servants when it came to something they wanted. And so the king demanded that they tell him what the dream was and give him the interpretation. Now, scholars are arguing still as to whether the king actually forgot the dream, or whether it was just somewhat hazy, or whether he really knew what the dream was and was testing out these magicians. You see, these wise men were supposedly wise in the religion of the Babylonians, in the study of the stars and the movement of the heavens and the other things that they related to. They claimed to have supernatural powers. And Nebuchadnezzar had inherited them from his father. And here he is, a young man, and you can imagine that he got a little restive with these old people. You know, the older people no doubt gave him some advice he didn't want, and he didn't like it too well. And he was a sharp person. He began to wonder whether all their pretenses about being supernaturally wise were true or not. There was something in Nebuchadnezzar that was inquiring for something that was real. And he didn't think they had it. And so he demanded that they tell him the dream and the interpretation. Of course, they came right back and said, well, if you'll tell us the dream, we'll give you the interpretation. You see, they could have cooked up something by way of interpretation if they knew what the dream was. But they couldn't stick out their necks and guess what the dream was. In fact, they didn't have the slightest idea. Well, Nebuchadnezzar was not known for an even-tempered character, you know. And he went into a rage. And he told them they were just gaining time to deceive him. And he said, if you don't tell me what the dream is and the interpretation, I'm going to kill every one of you. Now, that sounds a little extreme, and it was, but you read the annals of kings back in those days, they didn't think a thing of killing thousands of people that served their purpose. And these magicians knew that this was true. These magicians knew this was true. And they tried their best, but no, he ordered them off, told them they were all going to be executed. Well, Daniel and his three companions were also classified as wise men, but for some reason they weren't called. Maybe they were still considered too young to participate in a high-level conference like this. But Arioch, the king who was over Daniel and his three companions, came and sought them out and told them that they were going to be executed. And Daniel said, what's the hurry? What's the trouble? So it was explained to him. Now, meanwhile, the king had cooled off a little bit, apparently. And by this time, it perhaps was morning. And Daniel requested to go in to see the king, and he was admitted to the king, which is amazing. And he asked for time. He says, I will interpret the dream. Well, the king was curious enough to find out whether this young lad, he wasn't even 20 years of age yet, who had been so smart among the students that had been in school, whether he could interpret the dream. This was really something that intrigued Nebuchadnezzar. So he gave Daniel time. And Daniel went back to his three companions, and they had a prayer meeting. Have you ever gone to a prayer meeting where if you didn't get the answer to prayer, you'd lose your life the next day? I can assure you it encourages prayer. And they didn't get sleepy even. They prayed on in the night. And then Daniel, by God's grace, was given a vision of the dream. He immediately went to Arioch, his superior, and said, I can interpret the dream. Well, Arioch was trying to get in all the mileage he could out of it, so he hustled into the king and says, I have found a man who could interpret the dream. We'll get a little credit for it, you know. And so the king asked Daniel to come. Now, before Daniel came, however, I want you to notice something, Daniel chapter 2, verse 19 and following. After the secret was revealed to Daniel, you know, if I'd have been in Daniel's place, I'd have rushed right out and found the ark. So I can interpret the dream. There's one thing about Daniel that's really remarkable. He never hurries. He never omits a courtesy. You remember the story in chapter 6? We're not going to spend much time on it. Daniel in the lion's den when they rescued him in the morning. And the king asked Daniel whether he was there. And he didn't say, get me out of here. He said, O king, live forever. All the courtesies were still there, in spite of the urgency. Well, here it was too. And he prays to the Lord. There's a sevenfold prayer here in Daniel chapter 2, beginning in verse 20. Daniel answered and said, first, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. Second, he changeth the times and the seasons. Third, He removeth kings and setteth up kings forth. He giveth wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to those who know understanding. Fifth, he revealeth the deep and secret things. Sixth, he knoweth what is in the darkness. And seventh, and the light dwelleth with him. Then he said in verse 23, I thank thee and praise thee, O thou God of my fathers, who hast given me wisdom and might and hast made known unto me now what we desire to thee, for thou hast now made known unto us the king's matter. And so then he told Arioch, and Arioch got him his audience to the king. And so he came before the king. In verse 26, the king said, Daniel was given the Babylonian name of Belteshazzar. Art thou able to make known unto me the dream which I have seen and the interpretation of it? And Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, now bear in mind, this is a teenager. But notice the cogency and the care of his words. He said, the secret which the king hath demanded, cannot the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, the soothsayers reveal unto the king. But there is a God in heaven who revealeth secrets and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. And with that brief introduction, he launches in and he tells the king the dream. And he says the king was lying in his bed awake, wondering about what the future holds. You know, Nebuchadnezzar is pretty smart. Here he was, the head of a great empire, and he'd been very, very successful putting together this huge empire. It was running smoothly. But he's, what's ahead? You know, we're living in a world that the philosophers call existential. Concentration on the present, ignore the past, ignore the future. Present values, live for the present. But a wise person asks, what's ahead? You remember Peter's question to the Lord in the upper room? He said, Lord, where are you going? Now, I don't think Peter intended that to be too profound. The Lord had said he was going to leave them, go back to the Father. But that is a very penetrating question. Where are you going? You see, if we understand the Bible correctly, human life once begins, never ends. We can lose our bodies, we can die physically, but we go on in conscious existence forever and ever and ever. And the question of where you're going becomes a very important question. And Nebuchadnezzar began to wonder, where am I going? What's going to be the course of my life and my kingdom? And what's after that? His Babylonian religion didn't give him any peace. Tranquility about the future. He was a smart man to ask that question. What does the future hold? And then he said, in answer to that, the Lord had given Nebuchadnezzar a vision, and he described this great image. It was an image of a man, really, but it stood close to his bed, and apparently it was much bigger than a man, perhaps 10 or 12, 14 feet high. And he described this vision. And it was brilliant with light. It wasn't just an ordinary person. And it wasn't a normal person at all. It was sort of like an idol. It had a head of gold. The upper part of the body was of silver. The lower part of the body and the thighs were brass or bronze. The legs were iron. And the feet were part iron and part clay. Pottery. And he said, as you watch this image, suddenly a stone came flying through the air like a missile. And it hit the image on the feet. And the whole image disintegrated into powder. And the wind came and blew it away until there was nothing left. Well, you can be sure Nebuchadnezzar was fascinated. This exactly was his dream. Now, what did it mean? Did it mean his kingdom was going to come apart? This was a catastrophe of some sort, obviously. You can be sure he hung on every word. And then Daniel gave him the interpretation. And I marvel at the beauty of his literary style here. These words are well chosen. There aren't many teenagers that could write something as well as Daniel spoke here. And he said, O king, Thou art a King of kings, for the God of heaven has given thee a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field and the fowls of the heavens hath he given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. Thou art the head of gold. Then he said, after thee there are going to come two inferior kingdoms. The upper part, silver. The second part, a third part, bronze or brass. And then he concentrated on the fourth kingdom, the legs and the feet. And he said, the fourth kingdom is going to be strong as iron, because it's going to break in pieces and conquer those that oppose it. But he said, you notice that the feet were made part of iron and part of clay. And of course, that isn't a good mixture. Clay and iron don't mix. They don't adhere to each other. They are brittle. And he said, as it's divided into iron and clay, it's going to be a divided kingdom. You can argue what that represents theologically, but apparently there's going to be division, either politically, theologically, or otherwise, racially, in the last days. And they're not going to adhere to each other. And the stone that's cut out without hands, Daniel said, is a kingdom that is never going to be destroyed. It's going to be a stone that's going to grow into a whole mountain until it occupies the whole earth. Now, there's a few things about this image before we see what it means. You notice, first of all, the image is very top-heavy. The specific gravity of these metals gets lighter as you go down. Gold is the heaviest. Silver is the next. And the third part, bronze, is still lighter, and iron is still lighter. Top-heavy image. And because its feet were iron and clay, it's weak at the bottom. And that's, of course, where the stone hits it. So it's something that's subject to destruction by its very structure. Now, when Nebuchadnezzar hears this, of course, he's tremendously impressed. As you move on into the book of Daniel, you discover that these four areas of the beast represent four empires. That is, Babylon was the first. And then as you move on into chapter 5, the Medes moved in, and that was the second kingdom represented by the silver. And then after that was the Grecian kingdom, which came in the 4th century under Alexander the Great. That's represented by the bronze. And then the two iron legs and the feet are represent the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire had the eastern and western divisions. And the feet stage represents the final form of the kingdom. Now, when this stone hits the image in the feet, it's succeeded by this stone that fills the whole earth. And this, it's quite obvious as you go on through the book of Daniel, is the fifth kingdom, the kingdom which comes from heaven. It's both a spiritual kingdom and the millennial kingdom, which Christ will bring in his second coming. In other words, it's predicting there will be these four empires, and then when Christ comes, it'll end what Christ himself referred to in Luke 21:24 as the times of the Gentiles. The times when Jerusalem and Israel is going to be under the power of Gentile powers. So the times of the Gentiles don't end until the second coming of Christ. When he comes, he will bring in his kingdom. And so in this pictorial presentation, you'll notice that it corresponds exactly to what history has unfolded up to the present time, and it corresponds exactly to what prophecy tells us will be the end of Gentile power when Jesus Christ comes. Now, when Nebuchadnezzar heard this, it says in verse 46, now mind you, he's the king of the greatest empire the world's ever known. It says, then King Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and worshipped Daniel, and commanded that they should offer an oblation and sweet odors unto him. The king answered unto Daniel and said, of a truth it is, that your God is the God of gods, and the Lord of lords, and a revealer of secrets, seeing thou couldst reveal this secret. Then the king made Daniel a great man, Now, mind you, he's a teenager still, 18 or 19 perhaps, and gave him many great gifts, made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon. That's the central capital of the empire, and chief of the governors over all the wise men of Babylon. Daniel requested of the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the fairs of the province of Babylon, but Daniel sat in the gate of the king. This was the beginning of some 40 years where Daniel was the right-hand man of Nebuchadnezzar, number one in the whole kingdom in terms of authority under Nebuchadnezzar. And no doubt the splendor of the kingdom and its success and its prosperity was traceable not only to Nebuchadnezzar's genius, but to Daniel's faithfulness to him. As the book of Daniel unfolds, we learn more about this. I want you to notice some things here. I've been presenting what is often known as the premillennial point of view, that the millennial kingdom is going to follow the second coming of Christ and be brought in by his second coming. But there is a very popular view that held sway for some centuries. It sort of went down the tube after World War I and World War II, known as postmillennialism. And it taught that through the gospel we were going to conquer the world, and that the stone was the gospel, and the gospel was going to destroy the power of evil in the world. Now, of course, we don't see much evidence of that today. In spite of all we're doing in Christianity, every day that goes by, the percentage of Christians in the world is less than it was the day before, even though there are great revivals. Even though thousands are coming to Christ, world population is expanding faster than the missionary effort. And it's not true. The gospel is not going to conquer the world. In fact, the Bible makes it very plain that things are going to get worse and worse. And climax in the most awful time, the time of great tribulation. No, the problems are going to be solved by the second coming of Christ, not by the first coming. When he comes, he will put down evil. He will destroy the remnants of Gentile power in the world. And he will establish his king, his kingdom, and his throne of David in the world, and will rule for 1,000 years before the final end comes for this present world. We move on into the new heaven and the new earth, the new Jerusalem, and eternity to come. As this chapter makes very clear, the climax and the victory over Gentile power is not a gradual process, but a sudden catastrophic blow that in one blow destroys the remnants of Gentile power, all that is piled up through the years. Gentile control the world, and Christ is going to come and take over. Now, this is a great chapter. It gives us in outline form history of the world from 600 B.C., to the end time. Now, the one thing this chapter does not do, and this is characteristic of all Old Testament prophecy, and that is it skips from the first coming of Christ to the time of the rapture and doesn't pay much attention to it. In other words, as far as Old Testament prophecy is concerned, this period doesn't really exist. And you could put the day before the rapture, Pentecost, when the church began, and the day after the rapture, and put them together, and you wouldn't have any trouble explaining Old Testament prophecy. It leaps this present age. And we have to understand that as we read the book of Daniel. It's not dealing with the church age. It's dealing with the times of the Gentiles, seen from the Old Testament perspective that jumps from the first coming to just before the second coming of Christ, as if there were no time gap between. I think the illustration that helps me in that is that of Dr. H.A. Ironside. He describes the prophetic outlook like a person looking at two distant mountain peaks. And from a distance, they seem side by side, as if they were just about equidistant. As you get closer, you discover that one is more distant than the other. And hidden from your view, from a distance, was a great valley that was between the two mountains. When you got to the first mountain, here was this great valley that stretched before you come to the second mountain. Now that valley is the present nation. So Daniel does not deal with that, but Daniel does deal with the progress of world history. And of course, it's followed its course. As we're going to see in the rest of the book of Daniel, Babylon was succeeded by the Medes and the Persians. They continued for 200 years. And then the Macedonians came on, the Grecian Empire, Alexander the Great. And it went on for a couple hundred years. And then the Roman Empire took over for a long period of time, the greatest empire of all history. And it gradually faded away. And of course, in prophecy, we believe that the Roman Empire is going to be revived in the end time in the form of a 10-nation kingdom, so that Daniel's picture, as if the fourth empire is continuous, is what the Old Testament prophets saw. And the ultimate destruction, it's described in the Bible, is the destruction of this fourth kingdom, the Roman Empire, in its revived form at the time of the second coming of Christ. Now, what do we learn from this? There's a great deal in this chapter that I haven't been able to bring out. One is how God is dealing with Nebuchadnezzar. It's very interesting as you move on through the book of Daniel to find that Nebuchadnezzar ultimately comes to faith. He's beginning to learn that the God of Daniel is the real God and not the Babylonian gods. You see here, Daniel was able from his God to interpret the dream, and all the wise men together couldn't offer what the dream was or its interpretation. And believe me, Nebuchadnezzar got the point. That's why he worshipped Daniel as a representative of the God of heaven. And ultimately, I believe Nebuchadnezzar came to trust in the God of Daniel. All of which illustrates something else. You can imagine how Daniel had to live all these years with this wicked man, Nebuchadnezzar, in the wicked palace, and all the temptations and the things that were true in Babylon. And through it all, he is absolutely unscathed. A holy life in an unholy world. Daniel's testimony, year after year after year, finally got through. And he was able to win Nebuchadnezzar. I'm sure he prayed for him every day. But it's what a wonderful illustration of a godly man living a godly life in an unholy world. Certainly we can all follow this example.